Good evening, beautiful family. My name is Clifford Brooks, and this is July 2022's Dante's Old South. Now, I'm not going to jibber-jabber too much in this one because we have a lot of great show to jump into. Up first, we have novelist Christopher Moore here to talk about his book in life. In the middle, we have poet Lynn Kimmon to talk about her first steps into the world of poetry. And rounding out the hour, we have Jennifer Espinoza here to talk about her life, her poetry, and her new book. A deep, deep, deep sense of gratitude goes out to both Richard Winham and Michael Amade for helping me keep this show between the ditches. If you're ever in Atlanta or Nashville, Cafe Intermezzo and the Red Phone Booth are a fantastic evening. They're easy to sell because they stand on their own. So, with that behind us, please sit down, get comfortable, and let's have a word with the incomparable Christopher Moore.
And up now on Dante's, we hear from New York Times best-selling author and hero of mine since Practical Demon Keeping, Mr. Christopher Moore. Christopher, how you doing, boss?
I'm good. Thank you.
You have an expansive career, and looking back, you've been around for a long time. What's up with that?
I just wouldn't go away when they told me, Cliff. That was the main thing. They should get out of here. I was like, no.
And that's the end of the show.
Yeah.
No, man, it's your prolific output is pulling a Charles Dickens here, beginning at the beginning. What drew you to words and storytelling specifically?
Well, initially, you know, my dad turned me onto books when I was really, before I could read, because he picked up the habit, I think, when he was a kid, reading books before they had TV and whatnot. And then when he went into the Navy, he, you know, was on a heavy cruiser in the Korean War and just read books to pass the time, you know?
Right.
So when I was a little kid growing up, my dad was a highway patrolman. And when he, on his day off, he went to the library and came home with a big stack of books that he'd read every week. And he brought me a stack of books even before I could read. So that was always like a weekly event kind of thing. It's like, oh, right, Here's my new books. And at first they were the picture books, and then they were, you know, Dr. Seuss and stuff like that. And so reading was just an important thing in my house. And I just picked it up from a really early age as a very legitimate thing to do. You know, that was a way that you could spend your time that, you know, I don't know if you got praise for it, but you certainly, nobody went, you know, stop messing that up.
Right.
So it was just reinforced a lot in my upbringing. And I think I was an only kid. So it was a way that I entertained myself. And so it became, I guess, akin to play for me.
You kind of snatched the words out of my mouth for that. The follow-up question I have for that is that, you know, in that state of mind, being an only child and being able to have such a rich imaginative life, did you find growing up that you spent more time alone or surrounded by friends?
Probably more time alone. I simply because of my situation. I mean, from age that I could remember, like 2 to 10 or so, I lived at the end of a cul-de-sac. We had one set of neighbors across the street, and there was this family that had 5 kids, and they had a son that was like a year younger than me. And so we played during the day, but there was no hanging out inside of each other's houses or any kind of thing like that. It's like in the winter, I would go months without, except for school, seeing another kid.
Right.
So it was mostly a lot of time on my own, which if you're an only kid, you know, people like, oh, that's too bad. And it was like, I didn't know that was anything but a cool thing. You know, right. I thought that was how you are, you know.
When you found that, when you discovered that you had a knack for words, when you were Practical Demon Keeping, is that your first book, correct?
That's my first book, yeah.
When did you realize that that was going to happen, that the novelist thing was going to be your path?
I think there's a difference between when I found out that I had some talent for it, which was really early on, like however old you are in sixth grade, 11, 12, to I think I was about 15 when I thought I would really like to be a writer, you know, and I was still getting reinforcement from stuff I wrote in school. All of it imaginative, going all the way back. It was the kind of stuff that I'm still doing now. I was doing in fifth grade, which shows you my level of emotional maturity. but I think about 16, I decided I wanted to try it. And like everybody who's brought up in a working class, you know, Midwestern Southern upbringing, I was told, well, you know, it's going to be really hard for you to make a living at that. Exactly. Which turned out to be very true. So I had a whole bunch of, not a whole bunch, but certainly other backup plans, you know, including, you know, manual labor, which turned out to be something I did fairly often. But I think that I was in my mid-20s or so, and I had done a bunch of other stuff for work when I went, okay, I got to make a full push for this.
Right.
Because I hadn't been able to finish a book at that point. And that was probably mid to early 80s. And it was already obvious that you couldn't make a living as a short story writer.
Right.
So I knew I had to finish books. I had to write and finish books. And you couldn't participate in the, is this any good, unless you actually finish something.
Yes.
So I'd say about 20, age 25, 26, I started, okay, I'm going to build my life around trying to do this. And then I didn't publish Practical Demon Keeping till I was 33. I didn't sell it till I was 33. I think I was 34 when it came out.
You've touched on something that I always like to get to if it comes up organically. And that's the idea that unless you only write, then you're not a writer. And earlier in your career, you've already mentioned, alluded to this. You had not only several backup plans, but you had some really random jobs in there, didn't you?
I did. And some of them were a lot of fun. I learned early on that you can't, and I would tell people when I would train them in these various jobs, whether it was working in a grocery store as a night clerk or as a waiter, is you have to honor the thing that pays your rent and that puts your food on your table. And because people that would come in and be like, I'm so much better than this, and I'm just doing this until I, you know, graduate from college or, you know, sell my first screenplay or whatever it is that their other goal they're approaching. And then you end up being kind of awful at the thing that's actually feeding you.
Exactly.
And I it was so easy to be a good waiter. You know, it was so easy to be like good at doing, you know, throwing stock and, you know, overnight and as a night clerk, that there was no reason to not do it well. And, you know, in instances of things like being a waiter, you got paid better if you did it better, you know.
Exactly.
So I did a lot of that stuff, but I wasn't unrealistic about the fact that I was going to have to, you know, pay rent and car payment and all that stuff with some other means other than writing, because I didn't want to be a journalist. I didn't want to write ads. I wanted to write fiction. And that meant sort of an all or nothing thing for me.
It's a go big or go home, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, with Practical Demon Keeping being your first novel, Razzmatazz is your newest one that came out last month. Tell us about that and give our listeners some background.
Yeah, that's my 18th novel. Mm-hmm. It's set in San Francisco, 1947. It's sort of a send-up of the noir tough guy genre. Mm-hmm. Which I did previously in a book that I cleverly titled Noir, so you couldn't miss what I was doing. And it just takes a lot of those conventions of noir fiction, which is like some working class mug who is just doing his job, and then some dame comes into his life and completely throws a stick into his spokes, and that's how it begins in noir. It was a way for me to talk about that period of time in the city. It was a way for me to write before there were cell phones, which ruined a lot of suspense fiction, you know?
Agreed.
Because everybody could know what was going on everywhere. So
immediately.
Yeah. And then you'd have to use the convention of, I can't get service. The only way you could have suspense was, you know, even that show True Detective on HBO, the first episode is like these two guys, they finally track down the serial killer and they conveniently can't get service and they go in alone without backup. And I'm like,
always, every
really?
Time.
Really? You guys worked a whole season on this and you had to fall back on the, I couldn't get service. So I have to go in alone after this guy that I know has killed 27 people violently.
with his bare hands. I always call that like the Stephen King ending where he'll charge you through like 3,000 pages and then at the end go, you slog through all that time for the easiest answer. Aliens. That's what we're going with. All right, homie.
Yeah, well, you know, I can't criticize Big Steve because sometimes
when you got
to get out of the story, you got to get out of the story. And apparently when he's writing one of those 1600 page things, he was having trouble getting out of the story. You know, you just got to push it.
It's true. Well, that's kind of brought me. Let's do this. How do you know when to eject yourself from a story? When do you know
I pretty much have an idea where I'm going. I will write without an outline, but I pretty much have I have an idea what a beginning is and I have an idea what an end is. And then I may not know how to get there, but I eventually will get there. So I've had books that have ended up a little bit longer, you know, maybe by a quarter. So in my books, that's about 100 pages, 125 pages longer than I thought to cover the material I wanted to cover, but I've never ended up like I know some authors who have, and I've known personally who said, oh my God, I was 800 pages in this thing and didn't know how to get out of it.
Right.
So I just am sort of working to a place and sometimes I don't know how to get that to that place. It's like, if you were leaving, you know, someplace on the East Coast and you knew you were going to LA, you might not know what road you were going to go, but you knew what direction, you know, and that's sort of what I end up doing with the book. And then I eventually get there, you know, and right. I have this, my act of faith is about around page 175, some cool way to end the book will occur to me.
Right.
And then when I go into the book, that's my leap of faith is like, well, I don't know how this is I'm going to get there, but somewhere along the line, it's going to occur to me, you know, and so far it has. Yeah.
It's an organized whimsy. It's kind of the way.
Yeah. You can always use the Shakespeare thing and you go, and then everybody died.
Exactly. The same thing. And then they were all saved and then they all died. Like, thanks, Shakespeare. It's the ghost in the machine, man. It's one thing that you can't nail down. And from the practical kind of side of that, I love this question. Of course, it's all about me. When you approach writing, how much natural ability do you think balances out with the technical skill of it in the practice? What does that equation look like for you?
I'm gonna cough. I'm sorry.
Cheap exit. Whatever, man. No self service, and I got to cough. I get you.
I think that's been adjusting, Cliff, as my career has gone up. I'm now in, I think this is my 30th year as a professional because I sold Practical Demon Keeping it came out in 1992. I actually sold it in 1990. So it's my 32nd year. And in the beginning, most of what I did was work and guessing.
Right.
And so every, you know, I would get to, I remember getting to scenes, Practical Demon Keeping, and going, well, that looks like just a lot of words on the page. Somebody should probably talk now.
Right.
You know, to put some air into the page, you know?
Yes, I know. Yes.
Well, you know, I don't think that way anymore. Now I know, oh, I'm writing in scenes and there's a structure to it and the scene has to accomplish something. And I've done this. And you run into, and when you're starting out, every problem you encounter in a manuscript, it's the first time you've ever encountered it,
right?
You know, and you know how awkward that can be. Yes. but when you've written a bunch of stuff, then you go, oh, I've done this before. So early on, I have to say that there were times I used to have a almost photographic memory of things that I had read. So I'd go, well, I'm not sure how I'm going to do this, but I remember Elmore Leonard handled a similar problem and it was on about the middle of the book on the right side of the page in this book. And I would go find that book and I would go, oh, that's how he did it. And sometimes that would knock loose how I would do it, not necessarily taking the road that he did.
Right.
But just by going, well, that's not how I'm going to work. What if I do this? Mm-hmm. And now as I have more books under my belt, a lot of it is muscle memory. A lot of it is, okay, I've done this before. Here's how to solve that problem.
Right.
Or maybe even I did it this way before. This would be a more clever way to solve this problem. It might be more interesting. So a lot of, in the beginning, it's a lot more guesswork and labor. And now as I'm older, it's what I guess would be muscle memory and innate talent, that maintains. I mean, there's no way to not sound arrogant when you're talking about talent, but you know, as you're in creative writing classes and then workshops and so forth, you know, you're listening to your own stuff against other people who are trying to do what you're doing, and you're going, okay, I've got an edge there. It's not, and I've never been competitive as an author.
Agreed.
But you have to, you're always wanting to measure where you are.
Right.
You know, and I was lucky, I guess the confluence of my upbringing and my life, you know, as a kid and going forward sort of conspired for me to have a certain affinity for putting words on paper in an order that, you know, in my case makes people laugh. So, you know, that's the talent part of it.
And it's, as we talk, you hit the nail on the head for me. I've got these one-liners that we can't say on NPR, but just your wit, it's Swiftian in its deafness, in a sense, but it never gets heavy. It never preaches. It's never mean. How do you accomplish that pure kind of humor on the page?
Well, one of the things I think is I'm not afraid to just throw all the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. I have no sense of pride of going, okay, it's just going to be goofy. And,
right.
And I don't care if the context is, because I've written three books that were based on Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't care. That's not going to stop me from having squirrels talk.
it didn't stop him, man.
Yeah. So I think that's part of it. And I always have tried to endeavor to not be mean-spirited.
Right.
And that was because for years people have asked me, where do you draw the line? I said that mean spiritedness. Now I will say that changed for me some years ago, politically.
Right.
You know, because I'm like, okay, these people deserve mean spiritedness, but not in my fiction, because my fiction, you know, there's no need. So if there's anything that's snarky and biting, it's usually directed at a character that I've constructed so that you as the reader will be satisfied that the protagonist said something snarky and biting to this person, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of what the Brits call taking the piss in my books, where,
yes,
where there's just kind of an everyman character and he's put up against, you know, somebody who's pretty puffed up and he lets the air out of him, you know.
The Falstaff character, you know, it's you don't let it get tropish, and it's always new. And again, you see where you've been inspired, but you never mimic, you know. And to the overcompassing idea here, we're talking in your eye, 32 years of doing this and mm-hmm. this enormous amount of work. And, you know, in the beginning, like, what's up with that? It's not a joke. How have you stayed this prolific over all these years, and that your subject matter is so, there's no book that sounds the same. How do you do that?
Well, part of it is just trying to expose myself to new material so that I can come up with things that are funny and interesting to me. Because mm-hmm. if I'm interesting and I go into research, and I do research my books, and people are like, you write goofy, funny books. And I'm like, yeah, but what you don't understand is by exposing myself to new knowledge, I'll find what's funny in that, because mm-hmm. my first default reaction to it is funny. So I might be writing a book about 19th century Paris, but I'll find something that's funny there.
Right.
And that's my first reaction. And that's how I've kept it fresh, is just by trying to attack new problems, new material, new things I find interesting. You know, I have a friend who's a painter, and he's an amateur painter, but because he has a really good job, but he's a really good painter. And his paintings are very technically perfect.
Right.
Right. But they're not imaginative. And he goes, I don't know how to do that. I go, just take two things that don't belong together and put them in the same picture. Right. And that's all I'm doing. I'm just taking elements that don't belong together and putting them in a scenario, putting them in a room and making them fight. You know, right. It's like putting bugs in a jar and shaking it and watch them fight. That's sort of, and that's how I, you know, as much as I've kept it fresh, that's how I keep it fresh, is to try and always be learning new stuff and exposing myself to new stuff. And I've been fortunate to not be in a position where I had to write so fast.
Right.
I couldn't do that. And there's some people who are get into the science fiction or crime genre, and it's, they don't have a choice. You know, they've right. done this immense world building that took them forever to do. They've got to write 5, 6, 7, 10 books in that world because they don't have time. They're, you know, they're not making enough money, and there's not enough time on the deadline to build a new world each time. And I've been fortunate enough that when I've needed to build a new world, I had the time to be able to do that.
How do you feel about the mantra, if it's not fun, don't do it?
Well, I would modify it somewhat in that if it's not funny, don't do it. Because I'm not going to, nobody's going to pay me for my elegant sentences. You know, the people are picking up my books because they're funny. And yeah. I'm constantly talking about how many times I look at a blurb on a jacket of a book and they go, it's hilarious. And I pick it up and I go, this book is not hilarious. I have been lied to, but I want people to get the satisfaction, unless they just have, you know, a sense of humor that they really have a high minded sort of New York Review of Books sense of humor. They might not work with my stuff, but I want people to enjoy themselves in the escape of my work. And so that creating that is fun for me. You know, it's getting a letter, you know, a 20 years after I've written a book saying this cracked me up and people thought on the bus thought I was insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like one of the most satisfying things that can happen to you as a writer, other than getting a giant check.
It's that your humility balanced with practical knowledge. You know, you read it on the page, you know, the technical skill, but then there's the bounce of you enjoy doing this. And you can hear you laughing when that happens, you know, that this is a moment shared. And you know, throughout all of the books, you know, and we, you know, we already kind of touched back on that. When you reach for that sense of humor, who are the comedians that you look back on, like the writers to help move your plot? When you think of humor, who are your favorite comedians that have inspired you?
Well, you know, it's funny that you use the term comedians, because you know, when I have taught workshops, I will right off the bat go, I cannot teach you to be funny,
right?
But I might be able to teach you comic timing, and you can learn comic timing from sources that aren't written. Mm-hmm. You know, there's people who are brilliant at comic timing, like David Sedaris,
yeah,
and Dave Barrett. David Sedaris, well, I can't listen to his books when I'm driving because I'm a danger to myself and others, because he'll just be sort of going along in a narrative voice that's la da da, and just he'll deliver a line that's unexpected, mm-hmm. and I'm shoot a beverage out my nose, and I'm going sideways in the median, but you can learn that. I mean, I learned timing from, you know, Eddie Murphy. Uh-huh. And Robin Williams, mm-hmm. and Jake Johansson, and all these comedians that came up that were doing stand-up when I was, you know, learning to write in the 80s. So comic timing came from, you know, Richard Pryor.
Yes.
You know, those guys are I learned timing from. I just also learned how to put that in prose. As far as prose goes, you know, there was, I read everything that was funny. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't tell you what, you know, really influenced me, I guess, but you know, Douglas Adams, I think Kurt Vonnegut, Tom Robbins, those guys, I mean, those guys kicked open a door that I was able to just walk through, especially Vonnegut and Robbins. And the reason I know that is I was told early on when I sold my first book, they went, well, Vonnegut and Robbins get away with this stuff and we don't know what they do.
Right.
And we don't know what this is, but those guys get away with it. So I know that I went through a door they opened. But, you know, I read all the way back to, you know, the Algonquin Round Table bunch with, you know, White and E.B. White and, mm-hmm. and James Thurber and that bunch, you know, because you're looking for anybody to give you a clue what you're doing. You're so convinced you don't know what you're doing. It's like, okay, this works, this works, this works. And, but I would say probably the most influence I had on how I structured my comic timing was from standups, and funny movies and stuff like that.
Well, as we wind this bad boy down, I always have the pack question, which, I mean, it always brings up my spirits too and my curiosity as well. That question is, what advice do you have for up and coming authors to not give up hope?
Well, that goes back to your question about if it ain't fun, don't do it.
Right.
You know, yeah. There's a million ways to make money. And probably more than you're going to make as a writer. So remember that you're doing this because you like to do it.
Right.
And you can, when you have a good day, when you put together a great paragraph or a good sequence or a couple of pages, there's nothing better. There's really nothing better. I mean, I can remember on Practical Theme Keeping where I didn't have any reinforcement that I was any good.
Right.
I can remember finishing a scene in that and just like grabbing, wrote it out by hand, pen mm-hmm. on a big chief pad mm-hmm. and running it out to the car and driving to my friend's place of work. And I went, dude, you got to listen to this. And, you know, he was a writer as well. And it was his place of work was a newspaper, but it's so satisfying. And, you know, all I can say is that you have to be satisfied with the work. There's a line from the Bhagavad Gita. It said, to the work you are entitled, but not the fruits thereof. If you're always looking for what's going to happen at the end of the rainbow, then you're probably not going to get to the end of the rainbow. But if you enjoy that time that you have on the page, solving those problems, putting those phrases together, then you're rewarded every day of your life. You're bulletproof when you got your pages done that day. You know,
I hope to know. I feel like I've got my fingertips on it, and there is no way we can move on with this show with the light you just shone, Christopher Moore. Your new novel is Razzmatazz, and it came out recently last month. Before I let you go, though, tell us how we can find you online. I highly recommend everyone to follow you on Twitter because that is legitimately some of the funniest stuff that takes me through the day. But how do we find you online and buy your books?
You can find me at chrismoore.com. And that'll get you most places you want to go, although I don't think I've updated the design of that page for 20 years. I'm at The Author Guy on Twitter. And remember to put the in there because there's some other guy that's always complaining that he's Author Guy and he's getting my people talking to him. So it's The Author Guy at The Author Guy at Twitter. Same thing on Facebook. I think if you just Google Christopher Moore, I'm one of the first two or three that come up. And my books are available everywhere that you sell books.
Christopher Moore, again, New York Times best-selling author. And a tremendous hero of mine. I cannot thank you enough for your time today on the show.
My pleasure, Cliff. Thank you for having me.
And before we have on our next guest, let's hear It Ain't Me, Babe by Bob Dylan.
Away from my window, leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone who's never weak but always strong to protect you and defend you, whether you are right or wrong. Someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. Go lightly from the ledge, babe. go lightly on the ground. I'm not the one you want, babe. I will only let you down. You say you're looking for someone who promised never to part, someone to close his eyes for you, someone to close his heart, someone who will die for you and more. But it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. Go melt back in the night. Everything inside is made of stone. There's nothing in here moving, and anyway, I'm not alone. You say you're looking for someone who'll pick you up each time you fall, to gather flowers constantly, and to come each time you call. A lover for your life and nothing more. But it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.
And up now on Dante's, we have poet, biopsychologist, teacher, and essay editor for the Blue Mountain Review, Lynn Kimmon. Lynn, how are you doing?
Doing great. Thank you for having me.
You and I have worked together for a little over a year now on poetry. And whether you like it or not, your first book is going to come out through Southern Collective Experience Press. I want the public to know that now. We own that bit because I personally watched you grow in less than 12 months, more than I have any poet I've had contact with. And it's not that you brought me finished products. You saw it. You sent it. And it can the learning curve at which you've been able to close is astounding. How has your life in general increased in joy since you've been able to take up words?
I can't imagine having gotten through this COVID experience without poetry. Mm-hmm. But I started the year before the world shut down. I am a board member for Bright Hill Press in Treadwell, New York, and mm-hmm. we're putting together a group of adults who are writing, and I agreed to do that. Mostly to be there to sort of let them in and hang out and make coffee and enjoy the process. But little did I know that I was going to become totally addicted to poetry all over again after a nearly 50-year hiatus.
That goes into my next question seamlessly. And that is, we talked about several times how you felt like you came to the poetry game or the creative game late. But you've had a change of heart recently. Tell us about that, please.
Okay. I would say when I first got back into writing, I was really in a tizzy about not having been writing consistently. I started writing probably when I was in junior high school and journaling, and I was an English and theater major, and it was all going swimmingly until I ran into a professor who sort of tore my work apart. And I said, I'll show him. I just won't write. And
that never works out. That never works out.
No, that never works out. So nearly 50 years later, I came back into writing in a creative and welcoming and nurturing space, and that made all the difference. Having said that, I was still beating myself up and going, I will never catch up to all these people who started writing and kept writing every day and never took a break. I now realize that whatever you're doing, it's going to contribute to the poetry or writing that you do. Your life experience is really important. And I think as an older writer, you have a lot more to add. You have a lot more to say. I certainly find that I can't shut up. I have lots and lots to say, having not said anything for a very long time. So where I urge anybody who's out there who is in the same situation where, oh, I haven't published, I haven't done this, I haven't done that, stop it. Just stop it and go ahead and do it. You're exactly where you're supposed to be. And someone said to me, talking about not writing, is it's not writer's block, it's quiet time. And that's where you do your creativity. So that's
true. It's true. It's true, Lynn. I mean, it's stop it. And what'd you say? I'm going to quote that. That's so many things I've stolen from you. Stop it and get to it. Stop it and get to it. It's true. And I've always, I remember Kenny Wayne Shepherd. He's a great musician, but I remember years ago when he first came out, they're like, we have a brand new 21-year-old blues phenom. I'm like, no, you have a guitar phenom there, but no 22-year-old knows the blues. Unless you started coal mining at 12, you don't know the blues by 22. It's within, when there's some miles under you, people think it makes you cynical. It makes you pragmatic, and poetry often lacks that. So in trying to urge folks, other writers, to be the best that they can be, do the best they can do, what advice do you have those coming up who want to follow in your footsteps?
Read everything you can get your hands on. Listen to spoken poetry and spoken word, because that's different from reading it on the page.
Agreed.
There's a lot of music in a good poem. And one of the things that I've been learning or trying to learn is how to make my music sing. And so I've always loved music. I don't read music. I listen to it all the time, but now I'm trying to make poetry that sings.
Well, since you brought up music, how does music factor into and play around your creative process?
Oh, music is in my head all the time. I have what I call earworms, refrains of songs or pieces of music that just play over and over until I do something about it, mm-hmm. or I catch another earworm. My range of interest in music is, I would say, eclectic. I like classical, I like jazz, I love blues, you name it. And that is part of what I do. It gets into my body, and from there it gets into the pen and into the words on the page.
It has to bleed from one to the other. And since you love music so much, let's shift a bit back to poetry. What is it about poetry specifically that called to you?
Oh, I think it can be so expressive and it can be so succinct. I find that I really like shorter poetry. And for a while I was writing haiku, and I was taking class with Clark Strand, and really being able to distill a thought or an image down to something that succinct was really an interesting challenge and something that I still like to do.
So as you cultivated your place in the world of poetry and have found a firm footing, what do you find now as someone who has been published in magazines across the nation? What do you feel like your responsibility is to your readers?
I hope that some of the thoughts that I have will resonate with people reading it. I hope that people will say, oh, I can do that, and do it. And you never know. You got to be in it to win it. I really think that the exercise of sitting down and putting down your thoughts and what's important to you is a really wonderful opportunity. And then you get to share it with other people if you're lucky.
That is absolutely it. That is absolutely it. Though there's very little luck in what you've done. I've watched your work. I've seen your work from afar and from up close. And we always want to kind of dismiss ourselves from the dedication it takes to the work, but you've got it. You own it in spades. And it's a pleasure and an honor to have you on the show finally after knowing you for over a year, Lynn. And we're going to have you on real soon, probably this fall when your book comes out, if you have time for us.
Absolutely.
All right, Lynn, thank you so much. And before our next guest, let's hear Numb by Gary Clark Jr. And rounding out this beautiful hour on Dante's, we have J. Jennifer Espinoza, a poet, trans advocate, and creative writing instructor at UC Riverside. Jennifer, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Did I get all that right? Is all that correct?
Yes. Yes. Perfect.
Awesome. 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 Now, Jennifer, I've been after you for an interview for, well, you know this. I was afraid you'd have a restraining order put on me. I don't know who this freak is, but please keep him away from my door. So thank you, Jennifer, for being on this show.
I appreciate your persistence because I just am not the best person when it comes to responding to messages, texting back, things like that. So no, I appreciate it.
Oh, no, I always love saying like busy people never give other busy people crap about being busy. You know,
exactly.
So when you hit me back, like I love reminders, I'm like, we're family. So Jennifer, yes, Jennifer, 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 tell us who you are, where you come from, and what makes you sing.
Whew, that's a big and also gorgeously articulated question. So I currently live in the Inland Empire region of California, where I've spent most of my life. It's one of those places where you either get out early or you kind of stick around. And I guess I'm one of those people who kind of stuck around, and I kind of had a chip on my shoulder about it for a long time. But I feel like with the poetry I've been writing and the work I've been doing in the community with like teaching at the local university, I've really started to feel myself like feel at home in this place for the first time in 34 years, which is really an interesting thing to like have lived in a place for a long time, but not actually felt at home there.
Yeah.
It's like I had to kind of create my own sense of home. I spent a lot of time in this region. I grew up in San Bernardino and there wasn't a whole lot to do. So I spent most of my time like wandering through nature and wandering through the outdoors and just kind of like being on my own and discovering things was really, I would say, like the genesis of my poetics. I just like being outside of family and church and all these other structures that I felt like were imposed on me as a child, just being out in nature and being free and like feeling the wind on my face and encountering new animals and plants I hadn't seen before. All of this kind of like sense of discovery really just prompted me to like want to continue to chase that sense of freedom and discovery and beauty. And so that's kind of like my main, like I said, like the genesis of my poetics. But then at the same time, like parallel to this, there's this whole like dysphoria I'm experiencing, abuse I'm experiencing at home and at school because of that. And just like all kinds of difficulties that I'm facing alongside this kind of desire for just being free and being in the beauty of nature. And so because of that kind of parallel struggle and that tension, I think my poetry ends up having this kind of mixture of like pain and like sadness, but also beauty and this like desire to reach for something more. So yeah, I think that growing up in a situation where I was simultaneously trapped and like pinned down, but also had these moments of being able to wander in this like open, like foothill kind of deserty environment, really like, I can't overstate how much this informed who I am today.
Right. Now, as an advocate member of the trans community, it fascinates me on what I don't know. And what are some of the biggest misconceptions about those in the trans community?
Honestly, and speaking to the current moment, I would say the biggest misconception is that we don't know who we are, that we're delusional or that we're making it up or that we want attention or that we're crazy. There's this idea that like, so for people who are otherwise ostensibly pro-body autonomy, that kind of like goes out the window with trans people. For some reason, we're considered like not capable of having the right to body autonomy because of this idea that we don't actually know who we are. We were tricked into being trans by somebody else, or we tricked ourselves into it or something like that. And so it's this really pernicious idea that like we're almost like infantilized and treated like children who can't think for ourselves and can't like get a hold of or articulate our own desires. And so that's really troubling to me as somebody who took a long time to accept myself and get here to this place. I didn't transition until my mid-20s, and everything before that is like, just like, it's still something I have to deal with on a daily basis of unpacking everything that I went through before I was able to transition. And so there's this idea again, that trans people don't really know ourselves, that we're making it up. And I mean, the first 25 years of my life is a testament to the falsehood of that idea, because it was just utter torment. And it was only upon coming out that I was able to once again access, like what I was telling you about earlier, that freedom, that sense of being in the open air, wind on my face, sun just warming my body, that like, I experienced that on a spiritual level when I transitioned and felt myself with like this sense of freedom and able to bloom into like the person I am. I was able to become more social. I was able to give love in a way that I couldn't before and accept love in a way that I couldn't before. I just totally, like, everything changed, and I got to discover like really who I was deep down at the core behind all of the layers that had built up in response to the things I'd experienced before that as a closeted trans person. So I think, I just wish people were willing to give trans people the benefit of the doubt and trust us when we say, like, we know who we are, like people know who they are.
Yeah. And the excitement, and there must be more than just a smidge of this excitement and re-evaluation and reinvention in your new book, which is coming out, I believe, in 2024, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Alice James Books graciously picked up my manuscript. It's titled, I Don't Want to Be Understood. And it's kind of a testament to this idea that for trans people, in order to be respected or have any kind of rights, it's like we have to explain ourselves and translate ourselves in a way that is like clear and legible to people who already don't believe us. So it's like you're playing a losing game when you're trying to convince somebody who has already made up their mind about you. Yeah. And that's kind of what the title speaks to. Like, I don't want to be understood on the terms of a world that doesn't want me to exist.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's good. when you talk, A Little Getting by T.S. Eliot keeps running through my head. So before I forget that, I'll send, if you haven't already read it, about coming back to the place you've known your whole life and seeing it for the first time, the excitement that you have that runs through you is infectious. And to ride on that current for a second, read us a poem, please, from your new collection.
Oh, I would love to. So this is a poem in the new collection. It was published by the outlet Them in 2017. So you can actually find this online if you do a little Googling. Nice. And this poem is titled Makeup Ritual. This is not another feminist poem about the tyranny of Western standards of beauty. Or maybe it is. As a trans woman, I'm still not sure what I'm allowed to contribute to the topic. According to some, I exist only to reinforce gendered violence, my body a blade sliding up and down the legs of real women, forcing its way under their arms and carving the language of misogyny into every surface. Wow, who knew I had so much power? I don't even leave the house unless I've had time to build a world on my face and make myself palatable for public consumption. Is it so wrong to be afraid when I've seen what can happen, when I've had it happen to me? In my life, there is nothing more beautiful than dissociating in front of a mirror and drawing perfect lines across the flesh, wrinkle to wrinkle, eyes rolling up into themselves, plastic pulling lashes into little curls. I live to cover my shadow with blood, to cake my entire image. For me, this means something like safety, like a hit of oxygen from a falling plane. The first time I saw my face made up, I couldn't help but cry it all off. What will I call myself now? I wondered. It helps to have a name, even though a name is a room you can never leave.
Jennifer, you are insanely talented, and you're the voice of not just change. I mean, people say change, things can change back quickly. You're a voice of lasting change, and it's one of the driving reasons that the Southern Collective Experience is beyond delighted to have you judge our upcoming poetry chat book contest, focus on the trans community. And you know, we'll be having a lot more about that coming up. Before I let you go, because I will keep you on here forever, because if you don't know anything about me, I will talk you to death. So to avoid that, because you have way too much to do in this life, tell us where we can find your books, because you have another one that's still out, and how we can find you on social media.
Okay, so for my first book that is currently out, you can get that at bookshop.org, and the book is titled There Should Be Flowers. My newest book is forthcoming in 2024, so keep an eye out for that. And as far as social media goes, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at sadqueer4life, and that's the number 4.
Well, Jennifer Espinoza, you have been an angel on this show, and as things develop in your life, we will have you back. All you have to do is reach out to me, and we'll make that happen, okay?
Oh, I can't wait. Thank you so much, Cliff. This has been lovely.
Thank you. You've been lovely.
And that brings us to the end of this mid-year July 2022's Dante's Old South. My name again is Clifford Brooks, and I want to thank you for spending this hour with me. My heart goes out to, and a big thank you to our guests, Christopher Moore, Lynn Kimmon, and Jennifer Espinoza. Richard Winham, Michael Amade, God bless you for helping me tame my madness. Let's all be a little nicer to one another, a little more understanding, as the world comes a little closer together, and we begin to have a new chance to show the love. Let's do it with respect and a quiet mind. I hope y'all have a wonderful evening, and I'll see you next month for Dante's Old South. Good night.
Stay with you.